Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us today is Ms. Rosie Tebogo-Motsepe. She is an award-winning actress, TV and radio presenter, a TV and film producer, author, voiceover artist, media trainer, global MC and activist, and a brand ambassador to several of South Africa's most famous brand names. Rosie also holds a Bachelor of Arts in Dramatic Arts from the University of Witwatersrand. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Womanity, Women in Unity, as a program, campaigns for the empowerment of women. And on the one hand, we always consider what women can do for themselves in terms of progress and development. But at the other hand, we have to consider that there are certain elements which almost serve to disempower women, one of them being abuse. Mm. At the end of last year, 2014, the Women's Ministry in South Africa launched their 365 Days campaign, which is aimed to bring government, private sector, civil society and others together in a year-long program to eradicate violence against women and children. Now, you are Vice President of Power, which is People Opposing Woman Abuse, an important organization which campaigns against woman and child abuse in South Africa. Can you tell us about some of the activities in the organization and how you came to become such an integral part of it?
It was by default. It was, you know, they always say it sometimes takes a negative to create a really a good positive. When I was at university, my first year, fell in love with a boy. There were different levels of abuse which he started before he actually hit me. Fortunately, I come from a family where my father always said, the minute a man raises his hand to you, you walk out the door. But, and like most families, no fault to him because that's how we were brought up. I was never taught about financial abuse, psychological abuse, emotional abuse.
Oh, and there's so many different levels and
layers.
Yeah,
and those are the ones, for me, I'm not saying that physical isn't serious, but those are a lot more hard-hitting, for want of a better phrase, purely because if somebody's breaking down your psyche and your emotional and telling you you're fat, you're stupid, ugly, you're never going to amount to anything, you're going to get to the point where you can't even look at yourself in the mirror. And so this is how he started to break it down. But fortunately for me, the night that he did hit me, it was the only one night. And the next day I'd called friends of mine at university because I was part of the drama society. And we'd organized this event. And he was very, very calculating because he took me around the back of the event. He hit me. And he goes, what are you going to do? I said, I'm sorry. And he got into my car. He drove my car and his cousin got into his car and drove me up the road and then proceeded to beat me outside the park. Just where it used to be the Civic Theater, now it's Johannesburg Theater. And while it was happening, I kept on looking up at his cousin thinking, obviously something's wrong. And his cousin sat in the car laughing.
So his cousin was there observing what was happening.
And fortunately for me, there were young kids in the street, and they were known as the Twilight Children all the time. And they were street children. And they came to my aid, and they tried, and he kicked them away. And then I managed to get away and got in my car and drove home. And driving home, not once did I think, let me go back and get help. All I kept on thinking was, I've done something wrong, nobody can know this.
So from an abuse point of view, it's a psychological element where you think that you've done something wrong.
Yeah. And then you've got to fix it, but nobody can know because there's also that shame factor.
Of course.
So when he got back to when I got back to my apartment and I was sharing the apartment with somebody else, and outside he was waiting for me and he continued. And then, I don't know where it came from, but the strength came where I screamed. And I think he got a bit of a fright and he left me. And I went in, my roommate was up, she saw what had happened, took me to the hospital. And then going back to my friends, so the next day when I called and I said to them, they were like, well, why don't you help us pack up? You just left and so forth. And I said to my friend, I was like, this is what happened, but please don't tell anybody. I don't want to come in now, my face is a bit swollen, just make an excuse for me. And there was silence and she was like, this is not on. And she put the phone down. And I went to sleep and everything, and 25 minutes later, all of my friends rocked up at the house. And if it wasn't for those men, they came back and they were like, listen, this is not on. This is not what men do, and this is not something that you need to take ownership of. It's not your fault. And although those were ringing through my ears, I mean, the first thing for me, and that's what got me through my healing, was that I knew that not every man was like that. But it did take me 9 years to realize to myself that actually it wasn't my fault, because I never spoke about it again. And then it came, ironically, I started Generations, and a woman's group from East London, the Masamanyani Women's Group, they gave me a call and said, as a TV personality, would I mind coming through and giving a talk on abuse? Not once in my mind did I think I need to talk about my abusive situation. So I went and I did all my research, and it was before our iPad and stuff. So it was all at the internet cafe. And my boyfriend at the time, we had a huge fight the night before. He wasn't abusive, but it was just one of those lover's tips. And the next day, I was so distraught thinking about what had happened, I'd left the speech that I'd written on the plane. And when I got off, I literally was whisked from the hotel to the venue where I was speaking. And I stood there, and then I spoke. And I spoke from the heart, and I spoke about what happened. And the more I spoke, the more I started choking. And the more I started then like breathing and then letting it out and looking in the audience, and I was relating to other women. And then afterwards, there was a standing ovation, and people were talking about it, and people were like, yeah, I'm glad you spoke about it because I've gone through it so long.
And it was having that authentic voice. It wasn't just another talk of something happening to a third party.
Yeah. You know, and then discussions with the organizers afterwards, it was weird because that was incredibly overpowering for me. And there was a journalist from Sunday Times, and he goes, do you want to report on this? I would love to report on this. And I said, yes. And the next day I thought, do I want to? And then I slept in and I prayed, and I was like, actually, no, I do. Because this is something that I need to get through. But the response from those women in that room means that if I'm feeling that and if they're feeling that, there are many other ones, you know. And then it's amazing when you put your mind to something, when the universe just opens up. Because then I started researching different organizations. And power kept on coming up. People opposing women abuse, people opposing women. But I could never get hold of the director. And I know to this day, she just thought, ugh, another celebrity just wants to do something for a PR image. And I couldn't get hold of her. And I was like, okay, the time will come. And then a friend of mine who is in marketing contacted me and said, listen, I'm bringing Eve Enzel out to South Africa. It was the first Vagina Monologues concert. Would I like to be part of it? But also, would I like to be the spokesperson? And I was like, yes, of course, it's fantastic. After Vagina Monologues, we gave a fantastic performance. And even then, after that, I was like, okay, I need to do a lot more. And lo and behold, we're sitting at the cocktail party, and there's a woman standing at the table, and I go introduce myself. She goes, hi, I'm Delphine. And I'm like, I know this name. So I said, Delphine who? She goes, Sarah Margaret. I was like, executive director of Power. She goes, yes. Oh my God, okay, sit down. This is a sign. You
know? So you found her
her, and I was like, okay, this is divine intervention. And, you know, I could see she was looking at me thinking I'm mad. But and then from there, I said, you know, I don't want to just go and be the face. That's not what I'm about. I need to do my training. And then, because I was on Generations, I used to get a lot of fan mail from prisoners. And they used to take up like 80% of my fan mail. And they were like, we would like to invite you, And I was like, I want to go to prison. Not really my thing, you know. And then I spoke to the ladies of power, and they said, well, maybe it might be a good thing. Because
and is this all from a prisoner point of view? And again, immediately in my mind, I'm thinking male prisoners.
Yeah, and so I said, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. And it was organized, and it was a special day, and it was just for the sexual offenders. And in my mind, I thought, well, there'll be a cage or something between us. I was like, there's going to be some form of protection. And second onto a field, and these guys came, and they literally sat just about a meter away, if that. And I was like, okay, Rosie, we're going to ride or die on this one. You know? And obviously, there were the cat whistling, the pessimist comments, negative comments. But then I took a deep breath, and I was like, okay, let's talk. And I spoke about my experience, and I spoke about what power does, and I spoke about the myths and misconceptions. And the dialogues that came out afterwards were incredibly encouraging, but also very worrying, because some of these guys had been incarcerated at a very, very young age. They didn't have a father figure. In their mind, women are not human. They're objects. So the one guy was like, no, but why must I listen to you? You're just an object. I just use you when I need to. And that's when power came in, and they created these different courses educating these guys. So when they do come out into society, they can integrate. They understand that the changes have happened. Because also some of them have been in for 10 to 15 years. And with the changeover of democracy, it's a totally different world that is on the outside.
Absolutely.
You know, so, and then from then on, I mean, it's interesting because then I met other prisoners, and I did a lot of stuff at Morderby Prison as well. But there's one guy who's phenomenal, and he was put in prison for most atrocious, atrocious crimes, but at a young age, realized what he did wrong, improved himself, came out. He now runs a radio station in Northwest, runs programs for young boys, getting them off the streets, teach them about violence and so forth. So, you know, as much as we have a lot of negative about our country and our judicial system, there is still a lot of good that's happening behind those doors.
But it's always challenging to come through to change a socialization, because that's what people have been indoctrinated in. And it becomes a vicious cycle. So that's very, very difficult to break.
Yeah.
But in terms of the other work that you're doing, I noticed that you were also representative as an ambassador for UN Women, and you did a climb to Kilimanjaro, highest peak in the African continent. And it was part of the cause. I read that it was to stop violence against women and girls in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then you climbed Kilimanjaro a second time, this time to raise awareness for the Tomorrow Trust and the Kilimanjaro Initiative.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the experience personally, and also more importantly, what, you know, doing the climb did to raise awareness of those specific causes?
The first one was incredibly daunting, because there wasn't anybody around me that I could say, okay, give me a tip, do it, so, like, you can go online and find out what you need to do, and they give you this breakdown. So there's nothing to prepare yourself for that. I have to say I was incredibly, incredibly upset not being able to reach the top. A couple of years later, I said, one day I will get to Uhuru. And when was it, 2013, I contacted Kilimanjaro Initiative, and it was the same people who took us up with UN. And then I said to Tomorrow Trust, because I also sit on the board, I said, well, I'll try and raise money for the organization. I started training, but also focusing my mind on it. And I contacted the organizer, and we've been friends since the last one for me, Kili Initiative, Tim Callan. And I said to him, I was like, do you think I can do it? He goes, are you mentally ready? Do you want to? Do you need a breakthrough? I said, yes. He goes, okay, then you can do it. And within 2 weeks, I was like, okay, let's do that, like, put everything together. And by the grace of God, the finances were in place. I was able to take a work, everything. And every single day, I was like, okay, there's a reason why, what I need to do. I need to get through this and see what other lessons I'm going to learn along the way. And that was my prayer before I set foot. And the first day went well, got into my own pace, obviously very strenuous. Second day, exactly the same. And then the same day, the third day after we were about to summit that evening, I got incredible, incredible heartburn. So when everyone was sleeping, I couldn't breathe. And I know it was partly anxiety. And so when we were woken up to get going or whatever, I started walking, and then I got violently ill. And I said to my guide, I was like, am I mounted? He goes, not. He goes, what do you want to do? I said, I need to get to Uhuru. So he goes, okay, let's take it slowly. Don't worry about your group. And we were walking with a group of about 25 people from states and South Africa, Kenya.
So that's quite a large group of people to manage.
Yeah. There are lots of guards guides that are with him. But this guide, I hadn't seen the first 3 days. It was the first time I'd recognized his face. And he goes, let's go slowly. And that's exactly what I did. I took the 10 steps. I ate. I prayed. I cried. Kept on going. Saw the point where I turned around the last time, cried, I was like, let's go. Turned to God, I was like, let's keep on pushing. And then out of the blue, my guy turned to me and goes, put on your sunglasses. And it was pitch black outside. I said, why am I getting mountain sickness? Because I kept on worried, I don't want to go down that route again. And he says to me, he goes, no, just put your sunglasses on and sit down. And as I did that, I saw the most breathtaking sunrise of my entire life. And he said to me, he goes, this is the problem with people who don't live here, is that you forget about the small stuff. And I was like, okay, that's another lesson. Because you're ready to go, I said, cool. Carried on going slowly, slowly, slowly. As we're getting to Gilman's, which about 10, 15 years ago was considered the top of Kilimanjaro, some of the group were coming down, and they were like, oh my God, we thought you turned around, whatever, very, very happy. Should we wait for you? And I was like, no, I need to get to Uhuru. So obviously got to Gilman's, took our pictures and what have you. And my guide said to me, he goes, can I convince you to go down? So I said, I need to get to Uhuru. He goes, you sure? So I said, yes. He goes, because you're 2 hours behind the group, we've literally got an hour to get there because the sun was coming out, the snow was going to melt, and it's very, very dangerous because that's when you can slip off the mountain and die. So he goes, but I think we'll pray together this time. So we sat down. He was praying to Allah, I was praying to Hashem. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And carried on walking, kept at my pace. By the grace of God, we're about to reach, and then I saw the rest of the crew coming back. Just such a beautiful moment, because some of the people that we had walked with were children who came from vulnerable or disadvantaged backgrounds, and I had discussions with them the night before. And there was one girl that we just, when the two of us broke down about the things and why we were doing this climb and what we needed to get through. And one of the things were, if we get through this, we can get through anything. And we locked eyes and we bawled. And my guide was like, okay, nice, enough crying, let's go. And got to Uhuru, whipped out the South African flag, so excited that it was even upside down, put on my Tomorrow Trust t-shirt, and I was like, okay, I did it. And I knew from there, I can get through anything. But more importantly, I can do it at my own pace.
Well, thanks for sharing those lessons of perseverance and your personal learnings through what you've experienced, whether it was from the abuse, going through and taking it further with power, and eventually getting to Uhuru.
Mm.
But I think one of the other elements that you mentioned, which was really important, was about doing it at your own pace and not at somebody else's. Dav, turning towards your acting career, you have got an extensive acting repertoire from the international circuit. You were in Oscar-nominated Hotel Rwanda, The Other Woman, Nothing But the Truth, and in your television roles, they've included acting on Generations, Boboom Sana, Stray Bullet, Zabalaza, and given the wide range on, and of course the far-reaching effects of media, plus its longevity, it plays an important role in cultural representation and social influence.
Yeah.
And I always consider that, particularly with women in Africa, it's important that they are appropriately portrayed in the media, that their voices are heard, and that they've got greater representation across all sectors. Mm. Do you find that, or is women's representation a factor when you're considering some of the roles that you take on?
Now, definitely. And that is one of the reasons why there's been such a big break in my acting career. Number one was I realized that there's a huge gap for female producers and directors, so I honed in my talent on that side. And then when this amazing role came for Zabalaza, and it was really, really exciting, and it was this powerful woman who uses her sexuality to get far, but doesn't necessarily mean that she sells sex. And I know that there were a lot of discrepancies and problems that I had with the writers and producers, and I kept on saying to my agent, I was like, there's the perception that if a black woman makes it somewhere, she's slept away all the way to the top. And we've got to stop doing that. And that if somebody's using a sexuality or somebody's sexy, doesn't mean I need to be flashing my breasts on screen or walking around half naked. Women don't have to do that anymore. They didn't have to do it before, but there was a time where people felt that way. So it's been quite an interesting journey of going into a space and claiming it and knowing what I do and don't have to do, and what I'm comfortable with, what I'm not. And I think that's very, very important, especially because there's a lot of young girls who've come in the industry with me, and were playing scenes with me. And yes, because they don't have the experience, and their voices aren't as loud enough, but they need to know that if a director says, okay, strip down, you don't have to. You know, and it's about your pride. And even if your character is that way, you've got to look in depth into exactly where your character's going. And if the storyline and the arcs don't tell you that at some point she strips naked and she's totally left vulnerable, if you're not told that at that front, and suddenly you're told to do it on set one day, you're allowed to walk off. You're allowed to put your foot down. You know. So it's been quite an interesting role, but I think also it's a reason why, I think it's another reason that God has put me in this position where I can voice up, and I'm coming from a voice from authorities. I'm not being a diva. I don't have to do that. No character has to do that. And especially with, as I said, with portrayal of black women, especially black women in business, you can get to the top without sleeping away, you know.
But do you find that this is also some elements between, in the acting environment, conflicting of characters and conflicting of personal values.
Yeah. It's very, 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 very difficult.
I think it was this year with the Oscars where we had Cate Blanchett talking. We had Patricia Arquette articulating not just in point of view of roles that are offered to women, but also from a remuneration perspective.
Yeah.
That women are sorely underpaid in the
industry. But that's a given in South Africa. I know for a fact that when I was in Generations, my male counterparts, even the ones that didn't have any studying behind them, got paid a substantial amount more than I did. You know, and that's still happening now. And that's another battle that we're fighting, you know. But also, and that was one of the reasons why for me I needed to get into the producer and the director space.
Well, you've got more control.
I got more control, but also, like my first film that I co-produced, I realized The Boys Club is so evident. And one of my mentors always said to me, Felicia Mabuza-Sattel, and was at an event and she was speaking, she says, as a woman, you need to always be prepared. Because the boys' club will be the boys' club. And they will always try and make you feel like, oh, no, you're overreacting. We're not being that way. So be prepared, because they're going to do stuff to exclude you. But you need to be prepared and clever. And don't play it on the tune that they're expecting you to. There's nothing wrong with being emotional, but you've got to choose your spaces to be emotional in. And that's exactly what happened, where my partners had all decided they're doing Berlin, they're doing whatever. And I was like, I need to get to these film festivals. And so I was like, okay, I need to be clever. And those words rang through my head. And I went and I seeked financial help. And it was very, very short notice. And I wasn't even mincing my words. I said, this is what's happening. Boom, 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 boom. And I was brought to the festivals. And at least I was there and representing myself as a producer. Because even in a lot of articles, my name was always omitted. You know, it was always putting the male counterparts. Then on the flip side, when we were going and sourcing funding, sitting down and literally men trying to put their hands on your lap, or if it was an international funder, oh, meet me in my hotel room and things like that. That, okay, we can be wise. I said, I can meet you at your hotel, but I'm not coming up to your room. Oh, what are you insinuating? I said, nothing whatsoever, but let's rather meet in the... And then knowing, well, I really want your money. Do I really want to be doing business with somebody who's got that snide mentality, you know? So, and it was difficult. And, you know, there was one time when I left a meeting, and I'll never forget, there was a scene in Sex and the City when Samantha was leaving a meeting, and in her mind she kept on saying, no emotion, no emotion. As she's walking to the lip, she starts crying, and that was me, and I'm getting to my car, and it was a fancy hotel where they had to bring your car. I was like, where's my car? Bring my car, bring my car. And the guy was like, okay, what's wrong? I was like, I said, just bring my car. I've got my car. I was like, oh, you know, crying away. But it's difficult, and I think more and more women need to talk about these issues and also be more collective. You know, a lot of the criticism that came from the film industry was like, well, what does an ex-actress and TV presenter know about producing? Little did a lot of people know that with Studio 53, I've been producing for a good couple of years. So it's very different from film. But then again, my other male counterparts have never produced at all, but nobody said anything to them.
Yes, there's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
And women, unfortunately, always bear the brunt.
Yeah.
And you're always having to prove yourself double or triple times than male counterparts.
Yeah.
But the reality is, you've made it.
Yeah.
You've
and
had
you get
the,
through it,
yeah,
you know.
You get
and,
through
and
it.
And with all that criticism, and I mean, we raised, and it's ironic because it was on the xenophobic violence that happened in 2008. And so we made the decision that we want to raise the funds, but we don't want a funder to have artistic rights over the film. So we didn't want a funder coming and saying, okay, well, I'll give you the money, but you need to hire Leonardo DiCaprio or somebody else. And so we raised the money through crowdfunding. And from a little minuscule amount of money to reaching a point where suddenly this phenomenal film was made, and we premiered, our world premiere was at the Toronto Film Festival. And for any African filmmaker, it's one of the most auspicious film festivals, because a lot of other international film festivals have an African section, which is usually put at the back room or not really part of the festival, and it's, you know, it hasn't given the right type of accreditation. But at Toronto, you've given the respect. So that was incredibly amazing and important for us. And then we got invited all around the world. And to date, we've won 14 global awards. You know, so from that day when somebody was like, you produce, oh, this I got to see. And then you see them at a local film festival and then looking down, you know, but that's, I suppose, also part of the challenge and pushes you.
And taking into consideration the challenges that you've had, the successes that you've also had along your career, and the experiences that you've accumulated from it, in your opinion, what areas do you think still need to be done with respect to women?
Honesty. And I think dialogue between women. You know, there's a lot of... I'm like a very anti-campaign at the moment, because whenever there's a problem, it's like, okay, well, we're going to do this campaign. No, let's just have this dialogue, but constant dialogue. And Wendy Luhabe created dialogue on the social feed. And when I saw her tweets and the things she's talking about, I've always had a huge amount of respect for her, but that even like quadrupled, because now she was going into a space that is not her generation. And she was speaking to the people that are going to listen and the people that need to hear those actions. So I think we need to have that action. More women need to be honest and stand up against organizations who are not protecting them. You know, and then also bringing back that sense of self-worth, because we're in a very, very dangerous position where girls are incredibly empowered, and it's beautiful because what they're saying, what they're believing, what they're standing for is amazing. But then we have the ones that have taken us 20 years, and it's not their fault, it's circumstances and so forth, but also the rise of the sugar daddy, you know, where young girls are having sex for 20 rand airtime, you know, so it's on that level of where did it go wrong that you don't believe in protecting yourself? Do you know you don't believe in your worth? And also it's that instant gratification, you know. And I've sat with at dinner parties where, and I think this is also part of the reason why I haven't got a partner in my life, because I'm not the type of girl that if you bring somebody to my house and she's not your wife and you have a wife, or she's not your permanent girlfriend, I'm not going to entertain this. And it happened a couple of years ago. I was living with somebody and his friends came over and I met these women and we had a great time. And then 2 weeks later, other women came. So I was rude to these women. And the one woman turned around, she goes, well, I'm his wife. I was like, oh my goodness, I was rude to the wrong person, you know. And that's just another thing where women need to get involved, is that stop turning a blind eye to it. You know somebody's cheating on somebody. You don't have to, it's not your place to go and tell everybody, but it's your place to say, actually, no, I don't want this in my environment. You know.
And on that note, in terms of women's empowerment, equality, all of those elements, we've had the South African Woman Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill, which started up but is now undergoing consultation and review.
Yeah.
In your opinion, how do you see legislation like this in helping advance women's issues?
It's very tricky, and I've been lambasted about it, but I still see we've got a long, long way to go. But those dialogues only happened when the time's right. So, you know, I don't do the 16 days of activism campaigns anymore. Women's Month, people say to me, okay, well, we need you to come and talk to the ladies. I was like, no, I want to speak to your company, because a lot of these situations that are happening are not because of the ladies. You know, and that's why it also goes back to the home on how you're going to bring up your children. You know, if little boys are told, well, it's a girl's job to wash the dishes, go sit down, it's not his fault when he gets to 18 and he believes that. Because you put him into that situation. You know, you've told the guy, listen, it's red all his life, meet him, it's green. And he's going to go, but what do you mean it's green? You're mad. No, you're the crazy one. Put her down. You know.
And that's where education is so incredibly important to change perspectives.
Yeah. Like a friend of mine was saying, she went to, I think she picked up a cousin or somebody from a ballet class, and I think her cousin must be about 5 or 6 years old. And there was a little boy there, dancing around with the tutu on. And I think that is amazing, you know, because I'm not saying it has anything to do with your sexuality, but there's that freedom of choice and also just showing that level of gender equality from the beginning.
Now, Rosie, one of the questions that I ask all my guests on the program who have made tremendous achievements in their respective fields is about the factors which have contributed to their success. Mm-hmm. And some people talk about hard work. Others talk about perseverance. Mm. In your opinion, what have been the key drivers on your success?
Definitely my mother. My biological mother was a domestic worker for a family who raised me. And only in my 30s did I realize, I mean, I've always known about the sacrifice, but did I really sit down, and I went through a whole existentialist crisis of who I am and so forth. But realizing the sacrifice and the challenges that she had growing up and what she did for me. So definitely her contribution to that. And, you know, I mean, she grew up, when I was growing up, my mother's always had high blood pressure. And now she doesn't have it anymore. She takes sugar tablets because it's not there. And realizing, and I've written a book about it, realizing that a lot of it could have been from the angst and anxiety of being in a displaced environment, number one, having your child there who's not your child, you know, and not acknowledging that and thinking, I mean, I'm sure, and she's agreed to it and said so, was that there was lots of times of thinking, will Rosie ever see us as our parents? And fortunately, I've gotten to that point very much later in my life, but at least I did. So a huge salute to my mother.
Well, that sounds like a pivotal period.
Yeah.
And in terms of your formative years growing up, can you share a bit more about that?
It actually, you know, because I grew up, I was the fifth child of the white family, and in my book I even write that I used to dream.
What's your book called?
I don't want to say yet.
Oh, is it still pending?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So we've got a new thing coming up. To talk about.
And so, what is that saying? So I would dream and pray before I went to sleep every night. Please, can I wake up like a little white girl with blonde hair? And having an identity crisis all the way through to my late 20s, thinking I dealt with it in my 30s, then, as I said before, it's like you need to go through these really hardships before you actually find the gold. And a lot of turmoil was happening within the family, within myself, with me, myself trying to find myself. And I was working for a Jewish radio station, and that just was going all wrong. And I decided, okay, I need to resign. Let me figure something out. And I'd been incredibly, incredibly ill for about 6 months prior to that, that I had an earache, ear problems, that I lost my hearing for a short while, came back, still not 100% right. And my body, I could just feel everything was just caving in. And you would need to listen to your body when that starts to happen. So from spastic colon to backache to everything. And then after I put in my resignation, I was driving on the highway, and I got the sharp pain all the way through my left side. And I could feel my arm going a little bit numb, and I pulled over. And I sat down and prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, and a voice said to me, go home. The same voice that said to me when I was on the mountain, the mountain will always be there. And I called my biological parents, and they live in Rustenburg, which is about 300 kilometers outside. And I said, Mama, can I come home? And she was like, of course. I said, no, I'm going to come home for a while. She goes, of course. And when I made that decision, I prayed again, and I saw the sign that said extra space in my head. Don't know where I'd seen it, and I remember the number. Called them, I said, I need to, how big is it, how much can I afford it, figured out maybe the space that I could use because I need to put all my furniture, pack up my apartment. And that's exactly what I did. And I drove home and I cried, and I cried out of fear, out of happiness, out of relief. And then when I got home, I just like slept and slept and slept, and I thought, okay, this is the time to work on my relationship with my parents. And to discover who they are, because I'd never had a conversation with my father. And for many years, I resented him because he drank a lot. No, he wasn't abusive, but I was just like, well, why couldn't he have been like my foster father who died when I was a very early age, but I had a wonderful upbringing with him. And it was those conversations that waking up in the morning and sitting outside and having coffee with my father and discovering this phenomenal, phenomenal man who actually was in a choir and he's baritone and he breaks out into the song. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I've missed out on all of this. You know, and now I understand where my creative gene comes from, you know, and speaking to my mother of where she came from, who we are, was mind-blowing for me. And it was, in my mind, I was going to be there for 3 months. And before I knew it, 18 months had passed. And it was the best. Yes, I took a bit of a pay cut because I wasn't in Joburg doing professional gigs, but I could handle my agency. But it was an absolute necessity.
And do you think that given your experiences and almost living a dual life and having that opportunity to catch up with your parents, that has had a big impact and influence on you now?
Absolutely. Positive and negative. You know, I was fortunate that I could face my demons and face the fact of my relationship with my father, my identity crises, all of that.
But today you've become a role model and you provided many women and girls in South Africa that with hard work and personal sacrifice, the things can be achieved. Can you share with us a few of the gender challenges that you've overcome during your career and also what advice you would give to young girls who want to become aspiring actresses, to almost walk in your footsteps?
You know what, the first thing is that you need to create your own journey. So you need to, and I've realized this, especially with the agency and how I take on somebody to represent, the first thing I ask them is that, what do you want to do and why do you want to achieve it? And if somebody wants to do the journey because they believe that they're talented and they want to and they want to get into roles and do that, beautiful. Let's go on that journey. Let's go. It's a lot of work, but let's go. But when somebody says, I want to do red carpets, I want to be in the papers, I'm like, cool, you probably will, but it's going to be short-lived. And also, it's not the energy I want to work with. And so going back to your first question is that there's going to be a lot of challenges, especially as women, you're going to be doubted. And then Jenna Clifford, who mentored me for a short while before, said to me is that one of the things that women fail at is that we try to play the game as a man. Men have their game. They have their testosterone. We don't have that. We have our estrogen. We have our inner power. And so, yes, you can be affirmative and you can be powerful, but you don't have to play it on that masculine energy. And that's something that I've taken to heed, is that you don't also lower your standards. And it was those words that rang through my head when the guy was putting his hand on my leg, or when somebody said to me, okay, well, let's meet up in my hotel room. You know, it's like, actually, no, that's environment I'm not happy with, and it's okay for me to be that way. And so the advice I would give to young people is that you need to know your worth, but map out your journey. My journey changes all the time. You know, I'll do my vision boards, I do my praying, I do my affirmations, and it's okay to change it, but do it according to your speed. You know, if I'd gone to climbing Kilimanjaro, if I kept to the speed to everybody else, I would never have gotten to the top. But I did it, and I noticed a lot more than what other people didn't. I saw the beauty in the journey. So it's about belief. And, you know, there's so many different sayings about following your passion. And remember, somebody can condemn your passion, but also see where they're coming from. Maybe they were too scared to follow their passion. That's why they don't want to follow. They want you to follow. Or they don't understand. You know, one of my family members, when the agency had just started and I wasn't doing acting work and things weren't that great. And you learn from those low times where there's the finances are bad, you don't know where you're going to get my rent money and so forth. And he's like, well, you know, your time's up, move on to something else, just get a job. And for a second I thought about it and I thought, well, I don't want to be miserable. I could get a 9-to-5 job. I'd been offered tenders before, I could be going down that route, but I don't want to. You know, and I've stuck to it. And that's why it's been, I mean, yesterday was my 20th year in the industry. And although it's had a lot of downs, but now we're on the up again. You know, and I don't regret anything. The only thing I do regret is that I didn't take a lot of I didn't take risks and jump into situations a lot more than I'm doing now.
But hindsight is 2020 vision. You know what? It's only something that we know about after we've actually done it.
Yeah.
And I heard a wonderful expression the other day when someone was saying exactly what you were saying. When people talk about the negative elements, that they're actually expressing their own fears. Mm. It's got nothing to do with you. Mm. It's how they perceive.
And it's okay. And sometimes, you know, yesterday was Nolene's last show. And she said, she was like, you know what? Who I really need to thank are the haters. You called me fat. You hated my hair. Did all of this. I enjoyed the journey. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about.
Yes. And overcoming those superficial, ridiculous nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now, in closing our discussion, could you please share a few words of inspiration that you'd like to pass on to girls and young women in the continent that are listening to us today?
First and foremost, be you. When people say, I want to be you when I grow up, I'm like, why? There's one Rosie already. Find who you need to be and follow that path. We could overlap on some of the things that we do, but don't think, okay, well, how would Rosie do it? No, think about how you're going to do it. And don't be scared to be you. You will get that criticism. You will be doubted. Expect that. If you don't, that means you're not on the right track. You're not being challenged. And life is a challenge. So when you're in a place and things are going great and you want to get to that next level, it means that you're ready. So make that leap. You know. So accept those challenges and also ask. One of the things in the beginning of my career was that I didn't ask people enough for advice. Asking for somebody advice doesn't mean that you're stupid, you know, and expect no. And if somebody says no and one door closes, create a window. You know, my first car ambassadorship, which was in fact my only car ambassadorship, I wanted BMW to sponsor me. And I went into a BMW dealership and I noticed that the only black people that were walking around at the time were the ones that were working at the back or were working in the workshop. I think maybe one or two salesperson, but it was predominantly white. Somebody said to me, no, well, why don't you go into town? It's black owned. You've got a better opportunity. I was like, no, wait a minute. So I went in and I bought a BMW and I drove it for a year. And I paid my installments on time, did my services. Then I found somebody who was like, okay, I need to put through the PowerPoint presentation for you. I said, let's get this meeting. I went in and I was like, I'm your buying power. But there's nobody coming through the door who's black and who knows about it. And prior to going to them also, I went to BMW head office. And they were like, the guy was like, we don't sponsor non-sports people, and we definitely don't sponsor women. I know he wanted to say black woman, but he was being PC. I was like, cool. So I went through this dealership, and I got the sponsorship. And I was expecting maybe 6 months to a year. I got the sponsorship 2004. It ended in 2008. And every 6 months, my car got upgraded because the only series BMW that's made in the country is a 3 Series. So whenever there was an update, I got that one. And, of course, got to drive all the other ones for a weekend.
What a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. But if I had listened to that guy in the beginning when he said, no, well, we don't sponsor, Who are you to tell me what I want and what's on my journey and what's on my vision board?
So don't ever take no for an answer. Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing your words of inspiration, for taking the time out to be with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Wonderful having you here. And we wish you all the best for the forthcoming publication of your book. And
thank
we'd
you.
Like to hear more details
you
once it's released.
You definitely will.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. And we've been talking to award-winning South African actress, director, producer, Miss Rosie Teboho Motsepe.